in 1 Samuel, the 21st chapter. In that chapter, David, who was fleeing from Saul, went into the tabernacle and he ate some of the showbread that was laid out on the table of showbread, an act that appears pretty clearly to have been unlawful according to the law of Moses. Centuries later, Jesus in the Gospels would reference David's actions in defense of his own disciples who were being criticized by the Pharisees. Interestingly enough, 1 Samuel 21 does not indicate any divine disapproval of David's actions. And so the question that sometimes runs through our minds is, was Jesus defending his disciples by affirming the innocence of David in eating of the showbread? Well, that's an introduction to at least one of the questions that we're going to be looking at this evening. The format of our study this evening is a little bit different than the traditional sermon. If you're visiting with us, occasionally I will take questions that have been submitted to me and answer them in this format. The questions, if there happens to be multiple questions, are not necessarily related to one another. And our objective, of course, is to try to answer these questions from the Scriptures. The answers, the questions are not necessarily related to one another, and the answers are my answers as we try to make application of the Scriptures to these items. This evening, we're going to look at two questions, hopefully. And the first question is actually related to our last question and answer sermon, in which there was a question regarding the chronology, the events around or surrounding the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. We answered three of those questions. There was a fourth question that we didn't get to, and I want to begin with that question this evening. Was Jesus actually 3 days and three nights in the tomb prior to his resurrection? And I'll say a little bit more about why this question is important as we begin to look at the question or as we get into it. The second question, as we've just introduced from 1 Samuel 21, is did God give David a pass when he ate the showbread in the tabernacle? That's not a question that has been specifically submitted to me, I will tell you that. We've discussed it just briefly or mentioned it in our Bible class, and so I thought I would talk a little bit more about it this evening as one of our questions. So let's begin talking about the first question. Was Jesus actually 3 days and three nights in the tomb prior to his resurrection? Jesus prophesied several times in the Gospels that he would be raised on the third day. In fact, in Matthew, the 17th chapter, and incidentally, all of the scriptures this evening are from the English Standard Version, not the David Williams Live translation, a living message. Verse 22 in Matthew 17, as they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. You'll find very similar language. In fact, I think the phrase is identical in Matthew, the 20th chapter, verses 18 and 19. Just to kind of complete our study, in Mark's gospel, in the 9th chapter and 31, the text says, "For he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise.'" There's a sermon there just from the standpoint that Jesus is pretty specific about what's going to happen to him in the future. But we're concerned particularly about this phrase, "after 3 days he will rise." And once again, same language appears in chapter 10, verses 33 and 34. Not to be outdone, Luke records the same thing. "On the third day he'll be raised." Same language in Luke chapter 18, verses 31 and through 33. And then the passage that was read by our brother Dave just a few moments ago in John, the 2nd chapter. Now, John 2 actually is early in the ministry of Jesus. And the Jews ask, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" And Jesus' response is, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." You see that in each of the accounts, the language is a little bit different, but very, very similar. "On the third day, after 3 days, in 3 days, I will raise it up." Of course, the Jews didn't understand that. They're thinking about the temple where Jesus was. Remember, Jesus had just finished cleansing the temple, and in so doing was challenging the authority of the high priest. And so they think of the physical temple that had been years and years in renovations. It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body, John records. And so later on, his disciples remembered that, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. So Jesus prophesied that he would be resurrected on the third day, after 3 days, in 3 days. He also, in Matthew the 12th chapter, in verse 40, gave a sign to the Jews. It was the sign of Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Well, are we to understand that expression, that phrase, in a literal fashion? 3 days, 3 nights. Can we count 3 days and 3 nights from the time that Jesus was crucified to the time of his resurrection? How would that chronology work if we were to take the phrase literally? One of the things, of course, that we need to understand and remember is that the Jews did count any portion of a day as an entire day. For instance, in Mark, the 31st chapter, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. So another similar phrase from some of the Gospels that we've already read. But I want you to look at Matthew 27. Interesting contrast here. This is, of course, the Jews talking with the governor, and they want to secure the tomb where Jesus has been buried so that there's no chance that there'll be a report of Jesus being raised, the body just being stolen. So they go to Pontius Pilate, and they say, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise.'" And now here's what their request is. "Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day." Notice the difference? They say that the claim was, "After 3 days, I will rise." But they just want the tomb secured until the third day. And the reason is, by the third day, any portion of each of the 3 days would be counted as a whole day. It would fit the 3 days after 3 days. Those statements, although they seem to be different, really are saying the same thing. Does that make sense to everybody? How many of you would like to hear that again? How many of you would like to skip to the next question? You don't get to do that. Even though in the English it's two different phrases, technically, you're talking about the same amount of time. And the reason is, the Jews would count any portion of a day as an entire day. Let me give you another illustration, because I hadn't intended to talk about this. But in Galatians, the second chapter, the Apostle Paul talks about, actually begins in chapter 1, about some of his visits to Jerusalem following his conversion. After 3 years, he went up to Jerusalem. Then in chapter 2, in verse 1 and 2, he says, "After 14 years, then again after 14 years, he went up to Jerusalem again." Well, when he says 14 years, can we just count in the life chronology of Paul 14 separate years? That period of 14 years could be as little as 12 years and just a few days, a fraction of a year. And the reason is, he could be counting a portion of a year, maybe a week or a month, as 1 year, and then 12 years, full years, and then another month, and that's the 14th year. So you got 1, 12, and 1, which even with pulpit math is 14 years. And the reason is, a portion of a year is counted as an entire year. This is the reason, one of the reasons, that the chronology of the Old Testament is sometimes difficult to nail down, because you're not always sure how they're counting the years or what portions of years they're counting. So these two phrases actually mean the same time. And that's why the Jews are willing to just have it until the third day. That'll suffice for their purposes. It appears in the scriptures that Jesus was crucified on Friday, that he ate the Lord's Supper with his disciples Thursday evening, and that he was then, what we would call Thursday evening, he was crucified on Friday, died that afternoon, and then was buried that day before evening. Now, if you look, and I've got before evening, but you have to understand the different ways that people interpret the expression evening. But verse 42 of Mark 15 says, "And when evening had come, since it was the day of preparation," that is, And Mark tells us what he means. The day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. In fact, they buried the body of Jesus hastily. Didn't really finish all the preparations that they wanted to make. That's why the women are coming on the first day of the week with additional spices to finish the burial process, to give a more comprehensive burial process. The process of his burial was hurried because they needed to finish it before the Sabbath began, when they shouldn't be working any longer. Luke chapter 23 and verse 54 says, it was the day of preparation and the Sabbath was beginning. That's right before their, or right after their getting ready to bury Jesus. The day of preparation typically was an expression to talk about the Friday before the beginning of the Sabbath. You prepared all the things that you were going to need so that you didn't have to work then on the Sabbath day. And so it appears as though Jesus was crucified on Friday, that afternoon, buried that day before evening. That would put him in the tomb a portion of Friday, all of Saturday, and then if he was raised early on the first day of the week, a portion of the first day. Someone says, but that's not three entire days. See last slide. When any portion of a day would be counted as a full day. So 3 days. But you know, that really doesn't solve the question or answer the question entirely, because the question is, was Jesus literally in the tomb 3 days and three nights? If you believe that Jesus was crucified on Friday, then you're going to have a hard time finding any way to look at the chronology and get three nights. But I think that's not what the Scriptures are requiring. I want to suggest to you that Jesus was actually in the grave for portions of 3 days and two nights, and that the expression 3 days and three nights was not intended to be a little literal expression, but more of a formulaic type expression to talk about 3 days. And so here's my answer. Jesus was not in the tomb for a literal 72 hours. I don't think there's any way that you can have him crucified on Friday and come up with 72 hours by the beginning of the first day of the week. Now, let me suggest to you that there are numerous schemes for the chronology of the last week, the Passion Week of Jesus. There are individuals who move his crucifixion all the way back to Wednesday, and the reason is they're looking for a literal 72 hours. I don't think the text is actually demanding that of us. But he was in for a portion of 3 days, and I think that's the equivalent, the Jewish equivalent at least, of 3 days and three nights. Jesus was buried late Friday afternoon and rose from the grave early on Sunday. Now, who cares? Jesus was raised. His resurrection is one of the proofs for his deity. That's Paul's comment in Romans 1 and verse 4. Jesus declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection or through the resurrection of the dead. And that's true. But sometimes when we're talking to people about the Bible, these are the kinds of things that they're going to point to and say, but wait a second, was Jesus really in the tomb for a literal 72 hours? We need to understand why that's not necessarily required. So that's the reason for addressing the question. Here's the second question. Did God give David a pass? And hopefully everybody remembers or knows what I mean by that. When he ate the showbread in the tabernacle, did God just say, that's okay, David? I know you shouldn't do that. It's against the law, or appears to be against the law of Moses, but it's okay. You're not going to be punished for it. Well, let's go back, especially if you haven't been in the adult class, and many of you have not been. Let's go back and see if we can't come up with the background, some of the details of the story of 1 Samuel 21. We know, of course, that there's been some discord between David and Saul. David has now been anointed already. Saul is still the king of Israel. David's been selected as the next king, and Saul has tried to kill David on several occasions. So here in chapter 21, David finds it necessary, due to the warning that he's given by Jonathan, Saul's son, to flee. And he comes to Nob, a city of priests, where the tabernacle was located at that point, and to Ahimelech, the high priest. So let's pick up the story here in 1 Samuel chapter 21. And verse 1. And Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, Why are you alone and no one with you? And David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest, truly women have been kept from us as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence. That's another way of talking about the show bread, the bread of the presence, the bread that was in the tabernacle, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there. Well, I guess we've read as far as we need to. He's fleeing from King Saul, and he stops at the tabernacle. He needs some food. Ahimelech, the high priest, informs him that the only bread that's available is the bread that was put in the tabernacle. It would have been in 2 stacks of 6, 12 loaves on the table of showbread. It was, according to the law, baked on the Sabbath, and the old bread taken out, the new bread brought in. But what David eats, apparently, is the bread that's in the tabernacle. The text talks about him going into the tabernacle, and Jesus says that when he refers to this event in the New Testament. Now, here's a key consideration, and that is that only the priests were supposed to eat that showbread. When the bread came out of the tabernacle after it had been there for a week, it was given to the priests. They were to eat it. David didn't have any right to eat that bread, according to Leviticus 24, verses 5 through 9. It belonged to the priests. We brought up in the class another issue, and that is that David goes into the tabernacle, apparently, to eat this bread, and he didn't have a right to do that either. The only people who could go into the tabernacle, into the sanctuary portion itself, if proper, were the priests. And so a couple of problems here with David and the law of Moses. Well, our interest this evening is the fact that Jesus referred to David's action on an occasion when the disciples of Jesus were being criticized by the Pharisees. Now, I've listed all of the synoptic accounts. It appears this story appears in all three of the synoptic gospels. What was happening was the disciples were passing through grain fields, and they were plucking the grain, and they were rubbing the chaff off of the grain and then eating that grain raw. They were doing it on the Sabbath day. That's the problem. You were allowed, according to Deuteronomy 25, you were allowed to take some grain just for your own eating. You couldn't harvest it, but you could take just to eat, passing through a field, and that wasn't a problem. And that's not what they're being criticized for here by the Pharisees in any of these passages. Just incidentally, the account in Matthew, if you want to turn to one of those passages, it's the most comprehensive account. We'll note that in just a few moments. But the disciples are plucking the grain on the Sabbath day. As far as the Jews were concerned, they were working on the Sabbath. A.T. Robertson makes this comment about this passage and the charge that was being made. He says, these critics, the Pharisees, are now watching a chance, and they jump at this violation of their Pharisaic rules for Sabbath observance. Well, what couldn't you do on the Sabbath? You weren't allowed to work. The disciples were plucking the heads of wheat, which to the Pharisees was reaping, that's work, and were rubbing them in their hands, which was threshing. So we got them. We nailed them. They're working on the Sabbath day, and that's a violation of the law of Moses. Another comment by a fellow by the name of Newman. He says, with reference to this particular charge, the New Jerusalem Bible renders, your disciples are doing something that is forbidden on the Sabbath. The New English Bible is similar. In the context, what is not lawful means what our Jewish religious law forbids. Jewish religious law refers to the traditions of the fathers. We read that phrase occasionally. No such prohibition is found in the Old Testament, meaning in the law of Moses proper. But the Pharisees pressed the laws that governed the Sabbath to include this regulation. The Pharisees gave the same authority to the laws which were derived from the Old Testament as the authority they gave to the Old Testament itself. Let me translate that. They'd taken the law of Moses, they made regulations in order to apply the law that you shouldn't work on the Sabbath, but their regulations to try to define how God's law should be applied became just as authoritative, as important as the law itself. You see the step there? Do we ever do that? We lose sight of what the law actually says, and then we decide how it should be applied. But now my interpretation of how the law should be applied is now just as important and authoritative as the law itself. That's what the Pharisees were doing, and that's why they're charging Jesus' disciples with working on the Sabbath day. Not violating the command itself, per se, not specifically, but violating the regulations that the Pharisees had derived in order to protect the Sabbath day from being violated. Now, I don't know how helpful you'll find this, but I'd like to spend just a moment talking about some of the differences in the synoptic accounts of this story. First of all, Matthew's account is the most comprehensive. And in Matthew's account, Jesus mentioned the work of the priests on the Sabbath. I want you to notice that because we're going to come back and talk about why he brings that up. And then secondly, in Matthew's account, Jesus quoted from Hosea 6:6, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice," is the way that some versions translate that citation. Mark and Luke don't include that quotation. And then finally, in Mark's account, Jesus makes this statement, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." Mark's account is the only one that makes that statement. However, you'll find in more than one account that the Lord, or the Son of Man, is the Lord of the Sabbath. He has authority over the Sabbath. And we understand that. Jesus is God. God's the one who made this law. Jesus is certainly qualified to define how it should be applied. So there are some differences in the account, and Matthew's account is the most comprehensive. I want you to notice from the text now, and I would encourage you to go to Matthew, the 12th chapter, and we'll point out a couple of very clear things that I think are significant for our understanding of why Jesus brought up David's action in the Old Testament. And the first one is, Jesus clearly affirms that David's actions were unlawful. There's not any way that we can get around the fact that David violated the law of Moses. If you look at Matthew, the 12th chapter, and let's begin in verse 3. He said to them, Jesus speaking to the Pharisees, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests?" We cannot argue that there was some sort of exception that allowed David to eat the bread. The law didn't stipulate any exception. Jesus said what he did was unlawful. He broke the law. Secondly, Jesus noted that the disciples, by contrast, were guiltless. They were not guilty. Let's continue reading here in verse 5, and then we'll get to verse 7. "Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you something," or in some versions it says "someone, greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means," quote, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless." Well, the Pharisees had condemned the disciples of Jesus because of their taking grain and rubbing the chaff off. They were charging them with working on the Sabbath. As far as the Pharisees were concerned, the disciples of Jesus were guilty. But Jesus says, if you'd understood these things, you would not have, how does he say? You would not have condemned the guiltless. So Jesus affirms two things. One, that David's actions clearly were unlawful, but that his disciples had not committed a sin here. They were guiltless, innocent in this particular matter. Well, that raises kind of an interesting question. If the disciples were innocent and David was guilty, why, when the disciples are criticized by the Pharisees, would Jesus bring up the case of David? Seems like that wouldn't help the case. That would hurt the case. Was he suggesting that David was, in fact, essentially blameless? despite the fact what the law said. The law said that only the priests were supposed to eat that bread. David ate the bread. That was clearly against the law, Leviticus. We saw the passage. Is Jesus saying that for some reason David really wasn't to be blamed? Now, the reason I bring that question up is that's the way some people look at this passage. That's the way some people interpret what's going on here, that what Jesus is doing is he's saying, okay, we've got two cases here. We got David in the Old Testament. David clearly did something that was wrong, but you know what? He wasn't condemned for it. God excused him, gave him a pass, so to speak. God showed him mercy and didn't require express obedience to the law. And see, the disciples are the same. The argument here is that the disciples were guiltless, not because they hadn't violated the law. They'd violated the Pharisaical traditions. They violated the law, but that's okay because they were hungry. And need sets aside law. That's the application that they take from 1 Samuel chapter 21 with David. Does everybody understand the point? Do you realize where you can go with that? If you accept that principle, if you accept the principle that circumstances will allow you to set aside the law of God, that mercy or emergencies allow you to set aside the law of God, I'm just curious where you'll stop. At what point do we say, no, wait a second, you have to obey the law of God because someone will always find some sort of circumstance that justifies the setting aside of God's law. The principle goes far beyond this business of eating bread in the tabernacle or threshing grain with your hands. Well, if that's a legitimate biblical principle, then so be it. I mean, you don't need to fight against the Scriptures if that's the conclusion that we ought to draw. But I'm not so quick. I don't think we ought to be so quick to surrender to that principle. I think there are some other things involved here. So, why did Jesus bring up David's action? We need to answer that question. Was he suggesting that David was blameless? Now, some commentators believe that that's essentially what happened. I've kind of given you the argument first. Now I'm going to give you some statements by a couple of fellows. Warren Wiersbe is somebody you may recognize, done a lot of writing, very popular writer. And here's his comment on this particular section. He says, Jesus used the word to answer his enemies. He used the Old Testament. He referred them to David, 1 Samuel 21:1, who hungered on the Sabbath and ate the sacred showbread from the tabernacle. At that time, David was a rejected king, just as Jesus was, but he had not yet been crowned. Christ also referred to the law, Numbers 28, which permitted the priest to labor on the Sabbath and offer sacrifices. That's the point that Matthew introduces that the other Gospels don't. Finally, he quoted from the prophets, Hosea 6:6, again, Matthew talks about this, to show that God is more interested in the heart than in empty outward observances. Christ boldly stated that he, not the Pharisees, was the Lord of the Sabbath, which was another way of claiming to be God since God had ordained the Sabbath. Do you see the argument that he's making here? To show that God is more interested in the heart than in empty outward observances. And that's exactly the way some people characterize obedience to God's law. Empty outward observances. Really, God's just interested in your heart. He's just interested in whether you're sincere. He's interested in whether you love him or not. What was it from the Williams translation this morning? John chapter 14. If you love me, keep my commandments. Jesus ties obedience and love for him together three times in one chapter, in just a few verses. But people want to separate those things. They want to talk about obedience as being empty outward observances. So it's not really important what the law said about whether you should eat the showbread or not. The important thing is that mercy was shown. That's the argument that's being made. Warren's argument. Well, here's another fellow by the name of Campbell, and he also comments on this, saying this. Jesus defends the disciples against the charge of Sabbath breaking by referring to 1 Samuel 21, where David ate the bread put aside for the priests. Although the bread was dedicated to God and therefore holy, God was not going to condemn David for eating it. The purity of the temple was not compromised by the king's action. No harm, no foul. He broke the law, but nobody got hurt by it. The purity of the temple wasn't harmed, so Don't worry about the law. And that's the defense, supposedly, that Jesus is making for his disciples. You Pharisees, you need to understand about mercy. Nobody's getting hurt here. If the law says you shouldn't work on the Sabbath day and my disciples are working, don't worry about it. Nobody's being hurt. That's the argument. And folks, people make those arguments about law, about responsibilities to God. Both of these comments lean toward the position that God will set aside his law in certain circumstances, in this case, for the sake of mercy. Well, we need to look at a couple of further considerations here. First of all, why did Jesus bring up the priests' work on the Sabbath? You ever wondered about that? In Matthew's account, he says, "Or this is verse 5, or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless?" Jesus gives an example of where individuals are doing things on the Sabbath, and yet they're not breaking the Sabbath law. They're guiltless. What's his conclusion? I think Jesus is defining what the Sabbath law meant, how it was supposed to be applied. And the Pharisees had gotten so far off track that they're worried about these regulations that they've piled up around the law for, at this point, centuries. And so Jesus says, listen, there are times when you can do things without violating the Sabbath. In fact, he says in the next pericope, in the next textual section here in Matthew, the 12th chapter, that it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Well, the priests went into the tabernacle on the Sabbath and did what they should because God commanded them to do that. They were literally working on the Sabbath, but God allowed it because that was his command. Now, I want you to drop down in chapter 12, down to verse 9. Matthew chapter 12, verse 9. He went on from there and entered their synagogue. And a man was there with a withered hand. And they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him? So, you know, the big setup. They're waiting to see if they can charge him with breaking the Sabbath. He said to them, which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Well, that's a rhetorical question. The answer, I think, that should be understood is, well, we would do that. We would do that because it's necessary. Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? So, here's the conclusion. Here's why Jesus says you can do that. So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. You see, the Pharisees had gotten to the point where they were so concerned with getting the laws together that they ceased to understand the point of the Sabbath law. You could do good on the Sabbath law. Jesus healed on the Sabbath law on more than one occasion, a number of occasions, and was criticized for it as though he were a lawbreaker. But Jesus says, no, it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. So whatever the Sabbath day meant, that law about keeping the Sabbath day holy, it did not exclude the doing of good on the Sabbath day. Now, you couldn't go out into your field and work for your own profit, for your own value. But if you saw your neighbor's ox in the ditch on the Sabbath day, you didn't walk by, you helped the ox out of the ditch, and that's work. If your sheep falls into a pit on the Sabbath day and you see it there, you can pull it out. That's doing good on the Sabbath day. And Jesus says it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. What about that whole Hosea 6, verse 6 thing? And if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. You know, sometimes people are very quick to look at a passage like that and say, well, you know what the passage is saying is that God's not really worried about this business of law. What he really is worried about is mercy, those kinds of things. He really wants mercy, not sacrifice. That's one of those statements. It's not typically in the not but construction, but it's the same concept. It's the idea of what's more important. You know, a sacrifice could turn out to be an empty outward observance, couldn't it? Isn't that what was happening in Malachi's day when they were offering the lame and the blind, you know, the blemished animals? Oh, they were offering sacrifice. But because their heart wasn't in the sacrifice, they're cutting corners. They're offering things that are really inadequate, that didn't meet the law. But you know, you could follow the pure dictates of the law, but if your heart isn't involved, then it just becomes empty ritual. Or you could be offering sacrifices on the first day, on the Sabbath day, and you'd be involved in worship to God. But then on Monday, or Sunday, I guess, we'll go to their week, on the first day of the week, you cheat your neighbor. So what good does it do for you to offer sacrifices as though you're honoring God and then dishonor God on the next day by cheating your neighbor, which was also against the law? See the point? It's kind of like what Samuel told Saul. To obey is better than sacrifice. The issue was obedience, not just the burning of animals or the offering of some sort of animal flesh. The Pharisees had lost track of that. They'd lost sight of that. And so they're emphasizing this law without thinking about what the law really meant. And so that's why Jesus emphasizes that it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. He's not defending David. In fact, in my opinion, I believe Jesus was using what we sometimes call an ad hominem argument. That he was reminding them that while they were condemning his disciples for breaking the Sabbath day, when in fact all they were breaking was Pharisaical traditions, while they would not condemn David for doing what was clearly unlawful, it's essentially an attempt to reveal their hypocrisy. They weren't being consistent about this. And I think that's the point of bringing up David's story. I think that's the point of it altogether. So let me give you my answer very quickly here. David clearly violated the law of Moses by eating the showbread. Jesus said that. He did that which was unlawful to do. But I believe Jesus' purpose in bringing up David's story, David's action, was not to declare David guiltless, but to show the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, who would condemn the disciples of Jesus, but not condemn David's actions. Now look at this last statement. Setting aside law for the sake of mercy is essentially another form of situational ethics. That's a phrase we need to be familiar with. Situational ethics typically is defined this way, that the quality or the standard for determining moral behavior is love. That you should do the loving thing in any situation. And that sometimes the loving thing means you set aside law and you just do something else. But if you do it for love, it's okay. Love defines what morality is in any particular circumstance. Situational ethics. Here, all we're doing is we're substituting mercy for love. But I'll tell you what, situational ethics just takes you in the places you don't want to go. There's no end to that. There's no end to the justification of immorality on the basis of the loving thing to do, as long as I get to define what the loving thing to do is. But when God says, love your neighbor, doesn't He expect that He's going to define what it means to love my neighbor? And that I ought to follow His definition, His standard. This is the big issue here in 1 Samuel 21 and more particularly in Matthew the 12th chapter. And that's why this question is important. I think we don't need to rush to the position of setting aside law. We need to understand what the prophets really meant when they said, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Sacrifice was commanded. Sacrifice just for the sake of killing animals and burning their flesh wasn't what God really was looking at, what He was interested in. I'll tell you what, though, that idea that God's law will be set aside in order to extend mercy is a really attractive one. It means that a lot of people who have basically ignored what God's law says are going to get mercy anyway. And it would be great if I could preach that. Because the borders of the kingdom then would be extended to people who don't have any intention, probably, of obeying the law of God. But I don't believe that's what the Bible teaches. The Pharisees were wrong to make laws for God. And that's what they were doing. And we are wrong if we set aside God's law. We don't have that right. And so when the Scriptures tell us that this is what's required of us, that once we've heard the gospel, that we need to respond to that gospel by believing and repenting of our sins, confessing our faith, the truth about Jesus, that He is the Son of God, the risen Savior, and then we need to be baptized for the remission of our sins, no other purpose, not to join a church, not because our parents want us to, not because our friends have, not because we've hit that magic age where everybody expects us to be baptized for the remission of sins, because I'm guilty before God of violating His law, and I'm a lost person. And God's willing to extend me mercy if I will participate in the death of Jesus Christ by being buried into His death, as Paul describes it in Romans the 6th chapter, in verses 3, 4, and 5, and 6. And then live faithfully, according to Hebrews 10:36, for the rest of my life. And I can't set aside the law of God. Those are the conditions that God has set forth for individuals to be saved. Are you saved? Are you ready for judgment? You need to obey the gospel. We want to encourage you, and we stand to sing in order to do so.